You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. We're talking today to Nancy McLean. She's a professor of history and public policy at Duke University, and she's author of several books. Her latest book is called Democracy in Chains. I've read this book from one end to the other, and it's a really gripping narrative about a little-known economist and his remarkable influence on American politics over the last half century. The issues that she writes about are of such great importance, I think, to our American democracy, and they reframe a lot of the debates that are going on in the media that seem to lead mostly to frustration and kind of like emotional arguments that don't really go anywhere. It's both refreshing and I think very important to see through the contentious media chatter and actually get down to the nuts and bolts of what's going on. And I think this book does that in a wonderful way. Nancy McLean will be in Santa Fe on Wednesday, March 7th at 7 o'clock. She's speaking at the Lenzic Center for Performing Arts as a guest of the Lannan Foundation. This is an extra program that's been added to the Lannan schedule, and Professor McLean will be in conversation with another distinguished historian, Greg Grandin. Welcome, Nancy McLean, to the Radio Cafe.
It's wonderful to be with you, Mayor Charlotte.
So this book gives us the profound and, I have to say, disturbing history behind the current libertarian Republican push to reshape the United States in its own image. And one of the things that's so interesting is it reminds us that there are these repeating cycles in American history. The book tells the story of an economist named James McGill Buchanan, who was in many ways the intellectual heir, as you write about, of John C. Calhoun. Before we get to Buchanan, tell us about who Calhoun was and what he stood for.
Yeah, it was really interesting for me to find this connection between Calhoun and a modern ultra-free market economist, because it is not what most of us would think about. But John C. Calhoun was once Vice President of the United States. He was a South Carolina senator. He was a slaveholder, and he was one of the most original, sadly, of American political theorists in the 19th century. And his contribution was to come up with a very anti-democratic understanding of our political system, and particularly the Constitution. As a slaveholder who was concerned about the power of other masters in his region, and slavery was an incredibly profitable capitalist enterprise in 19th century America, after the invention of the cotton gin, Calhoun could see the writing on the wall and see that Northerners were turning against the institution of slavery. Some states had outlawed it. Public opinion was beginning to turn against it, and he wanted to protect these rights of these property owners from the reach of democratic majorities, national democratic majorities. And so he came up with his own particular interpretation of the Constitution and how you might interpret the Constitution so as to prevent that, to prevent democracy from reaching this most extreme form of property rights absolutism, which was the ownership of other human beings. And James Buchanan, more than a century later, moved to Virginia just as the state of Virginia was reviving John C. Calhoun's constitutional theories to fight Brown versus Board of Education in the late 1950s as part of what was called massive resistance to Brown. So Buchanan, and it's interesting, Buchanan said that before he went to Virginia, he was more interested in yard work than in innovation in political economy. But he comes into this hothouse environment where all these questions are being taken up, and he too begins to think in new ways about political economy, about government, taxation, spending, democracy, etc., and he develops a new school of thought called the Virginia School. And interestingly, his own colleagues at his last institution, two people who are funded by Charles Koch, one of the richest and most messianic public figures of our time, his two colleagues wrote that John C. Calhoun was a precursor to Buchanan's thought. That was their word. And they said the two schools of thought had the same purpose and effect, the same purpose and effect. And I felt that I couldn't agree more that this is a kind of property supremacy to contain democracy. And so I ended up writing the prologue to the book about John C. Calhoun.
Now, James Buchanan was born about 100 years ago. He grew up in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And as you said, he rose to prominence during this whole aftermath of the Supreme Court decision, Brown versus Board of Education, which mm-hmm. was about desegregating the schools and getting rid of this separate but equal doctrine. Mm-hmm. But what I didn't know and what you describe in such detail is the reaction against it. Mm-hmm. It was a really intense reaction in a lot of places, including Virginia. What did that look like?
Yeah, it was a fierce reaction. And actually, although the verb to privatize did not exist then, it was not part of our vocabulary as it has become in recent years, this was actually the first modern moment that I, as a historian, am aware of, where there was a constituency of people who were pushing to privatize public education. And they were doing so because private schools would be beyond the reach of the Supreme Court decision, Brown versus Board of Education. So the early libertarian cause of these, you know, people who are very hostile to government and believe that the market could solve all our problems, that corporations could solve all our problems, they latched on to Brown, to the reaction in the South against Brown, and were very excited by the fact that these Southern white leaders, elected officials and legislators and so forth, were trying to privatize education or were threatening to privatize education. So that just fascinated me, because that is a story that we had never heard about in the literature about free market fundamentalism. And it was really extremely dramatic and really heartrending. For example, in the fall of 1958, as part of this massive resistance legislation, the governor was compelled by the legislation passed by the Virginia House of Delegates to shut down schools in any locality that desegregated. And so in response to that, the governor in the fall of 1958 shut down public schools in Charlottesville, which has lately been in the news, in Norfolk, and in an area called Front Royal, and locked 13,000 white children out of schools because it was white schools that were going to be desegregated. You know, white people weren't trying to get into black schools because they were so poorly funded, but black students were applying to, trying to desegregate the white schools. And so they locked 13,000 white children out of school for the whole fall of 1958 until the courts stopped them in January of 1959. And then in the fall of 1959, this community in Southside Virginia, Prince Edward County, completely locked out all the black children from formal education while sending white children off to a private segregation academy. And so these black children did not have formal schooling for 5 years. Kids from first grade to 12th grade had no formal education for 5 years in what the county leaders said was a stand for individual liberty and states' rights.
Yeah, I mean, states' rights seems like one of the many terms that is used to point to what is essentially pure racism.
Interesting that you should say that, because, yes, it was seen as, I believe a phrase of one of the people who was involved in this at the time said that, how did he put it, to raise this above the mean ground of race or whatever. They kind of appealed to these constitutional principles, but it ended up being a way that Southern segregationists and Northern business conservatives could come together, because these Northern business conservatives had been kind of outraged about the expansion of federal power from the progressive era forward with things like the Pure Food and Drug Act, and particularly though since the New Deal, when the federal government had supported the rights of workers to organize in labor unions and had provided social insurance in the form of Social Security and then later in the 60s Medicare, and and done other things, Fair Labor Standards Act and so forth. And to these business conservatives, that was an outrage, right? That was a violation of their property rights. And so they saw in the segregation as South's upholding of states' rights a way to have their own needs met in pushing back against the federal government, pushing back against labor unions. And not a few also, had white supremacist ideas themselves. So, for some, it wasn't even a conflict to think about aligning with these Southern segregationists.
James Buchanan won a Nobel Prize in 1986 for something called public choice theory. His ideas and his work were eventually adopted, as you said, by the billionaire libertarian Charles Koch, mm-hmm. with whom he had a real meeting of the minds and an institutional collaboration. explain to us the basics of their particular libertarian vision. Mm-hmm. I'm not that the two of them are necessarily identical, but that basic vision is an entire ideology for fundamentally reshaping the United States. And they've taken a very long view. As you say, Koch is very, very patient. I mean, this is a decades-long view mm-hmm. for trying to implement this vision. What do they want? What are the philosophical and economic underpinnings of this theory?
Yeah, so this is a theory that Buchanan himself described as the economic analysis of politics. But that is actually too broad a phrase because there's other forms of economic analysis of politics. What he did that was distinctive was to apply kind of neoclassical economic assumptions about individual actors in the market and apply those to actors in public life. So that school of thought thinks about economic actors as being individuals. You can't think of them at all as members of groups. You must think about them as only individuals pursuing their own individual utility, their own individual self-interest. And so that is what Buchanan did, turning that lens toward public actors. And he actually said in a documentary that came out in 2007 that when he set to work in the late 1950s, most people believed that elected officials, you know, public actors of different kinds, were acting in pursuit of the common good, right, of the public interest. And he said in this documentary, he said, that's what I wanted to tear down, the hypocrisy of calling something in the public interest. So what I heard, I was like, wow, you know, that's interesting. And basically what he was trying to do was, in a sense, tarnish public actors, right, to say that, no, you know, they're not really trying to do best by the society as a whole. What they're really trying to do is buy votes from particular constituencies. And this was like an old saw on the right that Buchanan turned into a kind of modern economic theory. But so the idea would be that politicians, yeah, they don't really care about senior citizens, but they know if they support Social Security, the pensions or something, they'll get more vote. Or they don't care about the schools, but they know that parents will vote. You know what I'm saying? That yeah. is very, very, very cynical and toxic. And I should say that his writing was all at the level of theory. It wasn't empirical. He had no evidence about people's motives, but he was projecting those motives onto them from his own theories. Anyway, to make a long story short, this ends up becoming a very, very pervasive ideology as trust in government also began to ebb in the wake of the Vietnam War, you know, and other such things. But what was important about Buchanan's ideas to Koch in particular is that they also provided a vision for how to kind of reverse engineer, you could say, the 20th century model of government as built up by citizen action. So, for example, Buchanan did not believe that public sector workers, you know, this is something in the news right now with the Janus case, Buchanan did not believe that public sector workers should have the right to unionize, right, and to exercise collective voice. He actually went so far on numerous occasions to say public sector workers should not even have the right to vote, right? So from his ideas, the Koch network realizes, too, that these public sector workers are very important in holding up the whole of the liberal state and being lobbyists for all kinds of other things that many people value. So they have focused single-mindedly on undermining the power of public sector worker organizations like the National Education Association, the American Federation of Teachers, American Federation of State and County Municipal Workers, and so forth. So that would be one direct application. Another aspect of Buchanan's thought that has been important to Koch is these notions of who should vote and who should have the right to vote. And they very much are trying to push people from voting who they don't think will vote with them. And so we've seen that in the various voter suppression measures that have passed in states controlled by this radicalized Republican Party. There's just a whole series of ways in which his ideas provided a kind of toolkit for radical change to achieve ends that most people don't want and don't support, but the billionaire donor network that Charles Koch has amassed do want, and they've become very, very adept at doing that. You know, we've seen this in the healthcare legislation. legislation. For example, you know, three very unpopular bills were defeated in the Senate, and yet in the tax bill that the Koch network was advising the Trump administration on at every step, they got rid of the individual mandate, which will in the end undermine the Affordable Care Act. So what they got from Buchanan was an intense focus on both incentives and rules in a way that would enable them to undermine government sort of by degrees. And ultimately, what they're seeking to do is alter the Constitution.
One of the things that's so interesting about this is that there's a lot of kind of weird inversions in it. Like, they talk about makers and takers. They talk about predator and prey. And so you would think that the makers would be somebody who, like, actually produce, you know, laborers who produce something, and the takers are those who take more than their share of their wages, let's say, or the predator is the exploiter and the prey is the exploited employee. I mean, we have wage theft in the town of Santa Fe. There's so many examples of that. For them, it's the opposite. For them, the makers are the wealthy capitalists, and the takers are those who try to get anything in the way of redistribution, public services. And for them, minority rights doesn't mean poor and disenfranchised people or racial minorities or anything like that. It means the wealthy minority who own the most wealth. It's kind of bizarre.
I like your phrase for it, and I think it's absolutely right to talk about this system of ideas as being full of inversions and inverting what most people think about who actually has power and who doesn't. And one of the things, going back to our discussion of John C. Calhoun, one of the things I found fascinating in this is that he was the first one to come up with this makers and takers framework, John C. Calhoun. And you just have to savor the incredible, it's beyond irony, you know, like the gall of that, actually, for a man who made money and lived a luxurious lifestyle because of his exploitation of unfree people, right? People that he held in slavery. He was calling himself a maker, you know? It boggles the mind, but he called himself a maker, and the people he called, I mean, he didn't use that language, he used a slightly different language, but it's the basic idea, and the people that he saw as the takers in his day were, of course, the slaves didn't have power. They couldn't vote. They couldn't challenge him. So it wasn't them, but the people he saw as the takers of his day were the small farmers, people who were, you know, on the marginal lands, who weren't the big planters, who wanted things like public schools for their kids, you know, or roads to get their crops to market, and things that government would have to tax planters for. And he, Calhoun, thought that they, those upcountry small farmers, were exploiting men like him. And I loved finding that out and seeing that actually Charles Koch had funded a libertarian, a very seminal libertarian thinker named Murray Rothbard, who himself pointed that out and said that John C. Calhoun had come up with this core idea of libertarian economics, and Buchanan then spun that into this whole theory, calling, exactly as you said, speaking of the productive, which he would include corporate executives and other people in business, and then parasites. He actually used the language of parasites, and that would be all the people who look to government for things they couldn't get from the market. So whether that's an environmentalist, you know, trying to clean up a polluted stream or area, or whether it's senior citizens seeking a drug benefit, or teachers seeking to lower class size, or people seeking health care for those who can't afford it, all of these things to Buchanan were parasites, and this was predatory behavior. And he was actually so committed to this idea that he wrote an article that became famous and highly influential on the right in the 1970s called The Samaritan's Dilemma, where he basically said that Jesus was wrong, that the ethics of Jesus, as described in The Samaritan's Dilemma, were dangerous in the modern world because they would invite such predatory behavior on people who had more.
Right. So helping somebody up when they fall down deprives them of the right to help themselves stand up, basically.
Yes, and that it's unfair to the, and it would lead them to keep not standing up, right? I guess, you know, to use the kind of visual image that you've come up with. Yeah, so it actually, that becomes part of the whole modern American rights approach to government assistance of various kinds. And you hear that when Paul Ryan talked about the government safety net that was becoming a hammock, or when Jeb Bush said that Americans Americans weren't working hard enough and they had to work harder. You know, all these kinds of things, that is echoing that school of thought that says that there are people lollygagging around and exploiting the wealthy and the corporations, which is really stunning when you look at the radical transfer of income up the ladder that's occurred over the last several decades with policies influenced by ideas like this. The idea that struggling people are the ones exploiting the wealthy people is not exactly supported by empirical evidence.
Well, that's the thing. And as you said in the book and just now, this is a theory that's not based in data. I don't know that there are studies that demonstrate that if you get rid of the things they want to do, get rid of the minimum wage, environmental protection, public education, labor rights, Medicare, Social Security, basically the entire public sector except police and the military, then everyone will be better off. I mean, what it sounds like to most of us, I would guess, is that they just want everything for themselves. Is it just as simple as that?
No, I don't think it's as simple as that, although I can certainly see why somebody would think that. Certainly for some people who are part of this cause, there is an element of greed, and Buchanan himself actually advised people on the right, including Charles Koch, beginning in the 1970s, that the way that they should turn things around was by creating a counterintelligentsia, Buchanan said, and the way to do that was to create a gravy train. So basically he was urging them to look for people who would be motivated by money, right, by getting jobs and, you know, the idea of doing well in this right-wing apparatus. So certainly there's some people who are just motivated by whatever you want to call them, venal calculations. But for both Buchanan and Koch, I think they believe this ideology very deeply. But I think part of the challenge is they believe it so deeply that no empirical refutation can challenge their ideas. So Buchanan was deeply opposed to the minimum wage, for example. And the only time, you know, and I went through all his papers, I don't know, thousands and thousands of published pages and private documents, and the only time I ever saw him expressing any empathy with any people of color was when he said that the minimum wage would hurt, in his phrase, the teenage black. And his idea was that by having a floor under wages, people who were struggling to get into the labor market couldn't do so. But the reality is study after study has disproved that. And you guys, I believe in Santa Fe, there's actually some significant research for when Santa Fe adopted a living wage ordinance that it did not have the dire effects that these people influenced by Buchanan-like ideas predicted. Quite the contrary, you know, there's some expansion of employment as you get more purchasing power into the economy and so forth. So I think for people like Buchanan and Koch, and Buchanan's now deceased, so we could just talk about Koch, but these ideas have really become a deadly dogma. That's how I think about them. And the reason I say that is particularly because they are so dead set against government that they refuse to believe that there is global warming, right? And they have put all kinds of money into climate science denial, into trying to push smog into the public debate about the climate and what's happening with the planet, because they don't want governments, who are the only bodies able to act on this threat to our planet, they don't want governments to have that power and be able to do that. So I think that's where you see that, you know, some ideas, I mean, who's not against freedom, right? I mean, who's against freedom? Like, most of us believe in freedom in some way, so you could see how libertarian ideas, when people are first exposed to them, could be attractive and make sense. But the more you dig into this cause, the more you do see that it's calcified into this dogma that is not susceptible to empirical refutation, and that I believe would result in a frightening society, a very unsustainable society by every measure, that people wouldn't want to live in. And I think that's why this cause is also relying on stealth, because they know that most people don't agree with these ideas and don't want to live in the world they're trying to create.
On the topic of freedom, I recently had a conversation with a conservative college professor of political science, and he was telling me about the inherent tension between liberty and equality. And after I thought about this afterwards, I was like, now hang on a second. For me as a woman, or for a person of color, equality is the path to liberty. They're not in tension with each other. They're one and the same. I'm never going to be able to be free and do what I want to do in my life if I'm a second class citizen. So liberty for libertarians has a very, kind of limited or constrained definition. What is that definition and what is it not?
Yeah, I think you expressed that so elegantly, and I wholly agree. And I would say, too, I would urge your readers to look up a poem by Langston Hughes, the Harlem Renaissance poet, and it's called Refugee in America, and there are only two stanzas. And the first one is about freedom, and is very positive. And the second one is about liberty, which he describes as being terrifying based on his history. And that speaks exactly to what you're raising here, in that for this libertarian cause, liberty is ultimately defined in economic terms. And it's about economic liberty for the people who already have property to not have anybody else interfere with their property, including through democratic means. And you can see that in their support of, for example, the dictatorship in Chile. Buchanan went and advised them on a constitution that could help the dictatorship lock in what they had achieved by destroying democracy and by, you know, they slaughtered, there's not a better word for it, over 3,000 people, killed others, tortured people, did all these things. And while they had unchallenged power, they did things like privatize the social security system, privatize most of the education system, undermine labor unions' ability to organize, and so forth. And so Buchanan and all these other people in this network of thinkers and business people he was part of, this Mont Pelerin Society, they pretty much bless this system in Chile, what was done in Chile, and then want to sort of bring it to America. So their definition of liberty is very much an economic definition, and it is a definition that in so over-protecting the rights of property to a point that I think of it as property supremacy, and so denigrating democracy and seeking to contain it, they would, just as you said, undermine the freedoms of most of us, the freedoms for which women, people of color, and working people have fought for over the course of the 20th century, and frankly, senior citizens too. You know, it was an old people's movement that brought us Social Security.
Yeah.
All of these groups who, as you say, through getting more equality, were able to experience more autonomy, more dignity, and more freedom in their lives. So I do see it as almost like a big lie kind of concept to say that there is some impossible tension between liberty and equality, where any effort toward equality is a threat to liberty, because you have to say, well, what kind of liberties and whose liberties, and are some people going to have their liberty protected at the expense of all of the rest of us?
Yeah. One of the things when you start looking at the details about this theory and this vision is that it doesn't really make any practical sense. So the idea is, well, we shouldn't have Social Security because everybody should save for retirement, but we also shouldn't have a minimum wage.
Yeah.
So even if you're making a minimum wage, you can't save for retirement because it's not enough to really live.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have a minimum wage, it'll be even less. And one of the things that they understood and that you make very clear in your book is that if the majority of people really knew what their platform was, if these libertarians were honest about their vision, they'd never get a majority. So they set out to subvert the majority in lots of different ways. And this is what you call the stealth program.
Mm-hmm.
What did and what does this look like?
Yeah, so you summarize that beautifully. The stealth program, just to make it really concrete, I think one place we might look is, you know, it's a broad plan for transformation that is being carried out by dozens of ostensibly separate national organizations. Then there's a couple hundred organizations that are part of something called the State Policy Network. Then there are a few hundred more organizations that are part of an international body called the Atlas Network. So we're talking a lot of organizing that is being funded by extremely wealthy right-wing ideologues like Charles Koch and the donors, the hundreds of donors he's brought together in the U.S. and their counterparts abroad. A perfect example of why I call it stealth is, say, in Scott Walker, in 2011, when Scott Walker, the new governor of Wisconsin, suddenly took away collective bargaining rights from public sector workers that they had for about 50 years, I think, by then. And he had never campaigned on that. He never told the public he wanted to do that. He said that he was dealing with a budget crisis, but the unions had expressed willingness to cooperate on that budget crisis. But he was really just creating a public fiction in order to achieve a predetermined goal that wasn't shared with the public, which is to destroy the collective power of working people. And so he actually said to his cabinet before he did it, he said, "This is our moment," you know, like our moment in history. And when he was talking to a caller who he thought was David Koch, he said, "We dropped the bomb. We dropped the bomb," right? So very, very clear that this is something that they had had under consideration, but they didn't share it with the public. And then once they had undermined collective bargaining rights and weakened the unions, then they also put into play voter suppression, a radical redistricting that has made it so that the Republican legislators there, as elsewhere, it's happened in other states too, are able to choose their voters rather than voters choosing their legislators. So these people like Scott Walker are being represented all out of proportion to their support in the electorate. And then his environmental department even said that people couldn't use the phrase climate change, among all the other changes that they were pushing through. So that's happening at the state level, but we also see it at the federal level, where through the threat of primary challenges from the right and these pools of dark money contributions for compliant Republican elected officials, the donors network convened by Charles Koch has made the Republican Party accountable to that donor network, not even to Republican voters. And we saw this with the health care. The three health care bills, none of them polled above 18%. None of them had majority support, even from Republicans. None of them polled majority support in any state in the union. And yet the Republican leadership in Congress, Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, were determined to rush these through in short order. And lots of Republicans were scratching their heads going, "Why are they doing this? This isn't what we want. This is terrible. This is awful." The reason they were doing it is because they had to please the donors or face this club of the primary challenges from them. And one of Koch's top political advisors and operatives, I believe it was Mark Holden, said about this process, he said, "This accountability play is our secret sauce," so to speak. That's how he described it. And what he meant by that is the way that they've changed the incentives so that the elected officials are kowtowing to these wealthy arch-right donors rather than the people who put them in office.
Well, that's another interesting point that you bring up, and I think it points to the fact that this whole movement doesn't really fall into the categories of liberal and conservative or even Democratic and Republican. As you say, they target Republicans who aren't to their liking, yeah, and they either get rid of them in primary challenges or make them bend to their will. They're certainly not trying to conserve anything. Certainly not the Constitution or its ideals.
Yeah, right.
How would you describe this? What is more accurate language that people can use to talk about this?
Well, I think that they should be described as the radical right because that's what they are. And in earlier years, they were honest about that and admitted it. But then they realized they couldn't get the voting strength they needed from that. So they started sailing under the banner of conservatism. But as you say, the last thing they are is conservative. You know, when you try to uproot Social Security, the most popular and effective social program that we've had, you know, in the last however many years, almost a century now, that is not conservative. That is radical. So I would say that. And I think you're right, like the labels just don't even make sense anymore. I think we should start speaking in terms of values, perhaps, and who we are and what we stand for. You know, I'm speaking out about this because I believe in a society that's fair, right? I believe in a society that's sustainable, where we're going to leave a decent planet for our children and our grandchildren. I believe in a world where we show compassion to people who are struggling while we also help people to get opportunities to work hard and achieve the things they want to. I think most Americans do agree on some values like that. But this right has us all screaming at each other through the kind of direct mail incitation, the radio incitation, you know, all the kinds of other stuff they push out there. But as you said, I mean, in some ways, like I believe in Social Security, I believe in environmental protection, I believe that there should be government action against, you know, to stop discrimination. And in this world right now, that is making me a conservative. right? Because I'm trying to protect those achievements of past generations, while these guys are coming through like a demolition derby trying to undermine that. So that language doesn't apply. But even the Republican Party, these guys have no loyalty to the Republican Party, most of them. I mean, Charles Koch funded a libertarian candidate to run against Ronald Reagan in 1980. He doesn't care about the Republican Party. What he wants is a delivery vehicle for his agenda, and the Republican Party was the closest tool at hand for that. And on that, we have the testimony of some Republicans themselves. For example, Orrin Hatch of Utah, when he was attacked by one of these primary challenges from the right some years ago, he said in public, he said, "These people aren't conservatives. They're not Republicans. They're radical libertarians. I can't stand these people." But he was disciplined by that primary challenge, and then it was Orrin Hatch who wouldn't let President Obama get a hearing for his Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland, right? And, you know, John Boehner called one of these people Lucifer in the flesh, you know? So my feeling is also that our journalists are not serving us well by not asking more questions of these Republicans who are fleeing from Congress and saying, what has happened to your party? How is it happening? Who is doing it? Tell the American people, because when you asked about how do we frame this, I don't think this is the exact right frame, but it's the best that I could come up with in the book. I described it as, you know, I asked this, is this a fifth column movement? And that's, you know, it's a fraud analogy from history, but here you have a group of people who is so hostile to our form of government as it has developed over the centuries, and they want to so radically change it that should we be thinking about them as a fifth column, right, that undermines government without being honest about what their purposes are?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't really, like, the fifth column concept doesn't resonate with me because I don't know it well enough historically. I was just thinking they want to make us into a third world country.
Yeah, well, I think you could also say that. Yeah, well, and the fifth column was more from the World War II era, but the notion of kind of internal enemies of democracy is how it was used then. But yes, I mean, the kinds of measures that they're promoting, and they openly talk about it, you know, very casually, but I quote someone who has long worked with Charles Koch on the academic side of this operation, where they have a base camp at George Mason University just across the Potomac from Washington. And this guy is a very popular writer, and he's often on the media and stuff. And he wrote this book where he talks about, well, you know, with the coming wage polarization, yes, we will probably have favela-style housing in the United States in some places, like the Brazilian shanty towns, right? Yeah. He says that much of America is going to start looking like Texas. He said that some communities that don't have as much money, well, they won't be able to count on the same quality of water that they had before. You know, and this book came out a few years before the Flint water crisis, and Charles Koch's funding of an organization in that state was responsible for the emergency manager appointments that led to that water crisis. So to me, it's just so chilling that somebody could sit in the comfort of an academic office funded by this right-wing billionaire and put out this stuff as though he's describing some phenomena just arising from the natural world, when in fact he's working hand in glove with a person and organizations who are pushing the public policy agenda that is bringing this kind of nightmarish dystopic world into being for most of the rest of us.
This kind of thinking, which was brought into being and popularized to the extent that it became popular, but certainly they've gotten votes for people like Scott Walker and many other Republicans, by institutes and scholarships and universities that supported it, and by manipulation of the federal judiciary, all this was rooted in people who were like Calhoun, who was very much pro-slavery, and the people who, after Brown versus Board of Education, were very much against having integrated schools. So you look at this, and then you look at the libertarians who are behind all this, and it's pretty much white guys, and you look at it, and you smell racism a mile away. But then under Ronald Reagan, these same libertarians were unable to implement their vision because it hurt not just people of color, but all working class people who fought back and said, no, we're going to keep our Social Security. So what is the role of race? Is it a divide and conquer tool? What's going on?
Yeah, I think it's really chilling. I think what this cause does is strategically leverage racism in order to move their agenda. So, like, libertarians have liked John C. Calhoun. Now, they would never say they liked him for being pro-slavery, right? Or for all that he said about white supremacy and all the horrible things he said about African Americans. They wouldn't say that. But what they'd say is that he supported property rights and states' rights and that that protects liberty. Wink, wink. You know, so the same thing for the Brown era. Buchanan, he never said, hey, I want to help people keep from integrating their schools. Instead, he said it's a violation of individual liberty and states' rights to have a federal decision like this. And if we had private schools, people could exercise their freedom to choose what they want. So you see, it would have it like this clean language, but I agree with you that there's a kind of a wink, wink quality to it that is signaling to particularly angry white people who feel that the development of an inclusive democracy has put privileges that they historically had made them vulnerable and that they have to share those privileges now with others, and that's upsetting to them. So this cause, this Coke-led cause, it's really so sleazy. You know, when you come to learn more about it, as I have through my research over this last decade, because they will, say, run academic programs to bring in faculty and to bring in undergraduates and graduate students, and even now they're reaching into the high schools. And in those programs, they will speak in these high-minded terms about liberty and, you know, freedom and the Constitution and blah, 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 blah. But at the same time, the same donor network is funding these organizations that are using racism and using homophobia to drive people to the polls. And I know this because my household has gotten on the mailing list of these groups in order to know what they're up to. And so, for example, in the run-up to the 2016 election, one of these organizations affiliated with the Koch Network, one of these organizations was sending out regular mailings saying, do you realize your election is about to be stolen by millions of illegal aliens, right? And that is just, that's just like a bold-faced agitational lie to get people who are afraid of the coming of immigrants to feel like they are being personally threatened, and so they must become aggressive to fight them. Because anybody who works with people who are undocumented knows they don't want to go vote. You know, the last thing you'd want to do is vote and get yourself drawn into the attention of the law and get deported. Now, we can have whatever discussion people want to have about immigration and is it the right level or the wrong level, but that is just a bold, direct appeal to racism as an accelerant to drive people to the polls. And we've seen similar things in North Carolina with using homophobia to get people, Republican-based voters, out to the polls when they wouldn't come for some of the other things these guys are pushing for. So it's a very strategic leveraging of prejudice in a way that is frankly dishonest and really exploitative, I think, of the people that they are targeting on both sides, the people who will be the victims of these ideas, but also the people that they are using, calculatedly agitating the fears, the anxieties, and the prejudices of, to make sure that they help them get the ball to the goalpost.
Well, I mean, I think the other big lie in this, which seems so obvious, it's hard for me to understand why everybody doesn't see it, is that they have no interest in elevating working class white voters. Those are the people who they see as being in the shanty towns along with everybody else. They don't want those people to organize. They don't want those people to be part of the American dream. And I understand the whole anger about people who feel like they've been cut out of the American dream, because they have, but it's not because of people of color or immigrants. It's precisely because of these very actors who are trying to make this kind of third world country in which almost everybody is poor.
Yeah, it's so interesting that you say that because it's just so true that if you actually look at the data, social mobility has plummeted in America, you know, over the last few decades to the point where it's lower in the U.S. than it is in Europe. You know, when this country was founded, people would talk about the new world versus the old world, and the new world is the place of opportunity and fairness where somebody who wasn't born with a silver spoon in their mouth could have a chance at success and a better life. And what's happened, as you say, is under policies that are directly influenced by and pushed by people like this, it's become harder and harder for ordinary people to climb up the ladder because the rungs have been taken out. You know, and we see that, for example, in the states. There are now 30 states that are completely dominated by this radicalized Republican Party. And in those states, they have so radically cut funding for education that it's putting it beyond reach of most people. You know, whether community colleges or higher education, all of these institutions are under threat to the point where in Kansas and in Oklahoma, even the Republican legislators finally balked because they saw that these ideas spread by these Koch-affiliated institutions were undermining, they were kind of cannibalizing their society. Their society was being destroyed by this constant tax cutting and budget cutting, and they realized that they had to raise taxes. So these ideas have been tried and they have failed again and again. And were it not for the huge amounts of money behind them and going into organizations that are designed to obscure the facts, like the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, Mercatus, et cetera, we would be having a very different public conversation about how we should go forward as a society in a way that can alleviate the anxiety and insecurity of so many people and restore us to a place of opportunity and freedom.
How much of this radical stealth plan has already been implemented? What's left? And what can citizens do? I mean, what is your hope for your book, for those who want to fight back?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this train is pretty far down the track. I quote in the book another Koch official gloating at one of their private invitation-only donors meetings, to which you have to pony up $100,000 to get in the door, gloating to them that he said, "We're close to winning. We're close to winning," he said. He was speaking of critics of the Koch network, but you could say the rest of the citizenry, they don't have the real path. They don't have the real path. Wow. So that real path is, as I've described, the stealth path, but it is also a path that our national media, because they focus so much on Washington, have largely missed. And this real path goes through controlling an ever-growing number of states. And as I just mentioned, they control both houses of the legislature in 30 states now, and they have what's called trifecta control in, I believe the last count is 26, where they control the governorship too. And in all those states, they're pushing through these radical changes from the most radical redistricting we've ever seen, so that, again, those Republican legislators are choosing the voters for their districts rather than letting the voters choose the legislators. They are doing voter suppression. They are undermining collective organizations of working people. They are stopping action on the climate. They are ending transparency. They are making radical changes. But ultimately, what they're also using that control over state governments to do is call a constitutional convention. Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution provides two paths to amending the Constitution, one through Congress, and then the measures go out to the states. We've done that 33 times. It's okay. No, it's good. You have public discussions. You need to update government. Fine. That's all good. But we have never, since that document was crafted, had a state called constitutional convention. And almost every legal expert out there, including some previous conservative Supreme Court justices, have said such a convention would necessarily be a runaway convention, and it could transform our country in a quite radical and dangerous direction. And that is what this Koch network is pushing for, to change our Constitution. So very scary, and they actually had, there are six more Republican-controlled states that have not yet authorized a convention. So I believe that the $1.5 trillion deficit that they've run up with this new tax bill, I believe that they will use that in order to tip those remaining six states over to authorizing a convention, unless that's stopped. So I think part of what's needed to do is to alert as many people as possible that this is, in fact, the strategy and the end game of this network. So kind of getting out the word. And I think there's a tremendous source of strength in the fact that they are so fearful of the majority that they want to go behind the back of the majority. So that says to me that the most critical work is to alert and inform as many people as possible about what these guys are up to, and then for those who are concerned, that they become active and organized and make their voices heard. And there are many good organizations out there that are working on different pieces of this. So, for example, Common Cause has worked hard on the Constitutional Convention, you know, so they'd be, and they're a very good source of information on it, so people could look to them. There are groups like the Center for Popular Democracy that are organizing, that are trying to include defense of democracy along with economic justice measures. There's groups like Greenpeace, you know, and Sierra Club who are trying to protect the environment and protect democracy with it, because having a functional democracy is so important to protecting the environment. So, I mean, I could go on. And I think, you know, some people are also active through their faith communities that are concerned about these issues, are concerned about inequality, are concerned about the destruction of our natural environment. So there's many, many, many ways that people can get involved. And they're probably going to be different for each individual, depending on their own knowledge and networks and talents and concerns. But I will say that as a historian, I believe this is an all-hands-on-deck moment for the defense of our democracy, and that what happens over the next 1 to 3 or 4 years will reverberate for generations to come. I believe it's that serious. And maybe I would just end by saying Charles Koch himself has boasted that in the last year under the Trump presidency, the Koch network has achieved more than it has in the previous 10 years. And Koch has also said in the last 5 years, they've achieved more than he was able to achieve for 50 years that he's been funding this cause. So it is the application of James Buchanan's thought, the weaponizing of it that I describe in Democracy in Chains, that is making this so effective, this donor money. So I think if people begin to understand what those ideas are and how they're being applied, that knowledge can be power for them to better defend and renew our democracy.
Nancy McLean is Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, and I'm really looking forward to my visit to Santa Fe.
The book is called Democracy in Chains, and once again, Nancy McLean will be in Santa Fe, New Mexico on Wednesday, March 7th at 7 o'clock. She's speaking at the Lenzick Center for Performing Arts. She's a guest of the Lannan Foundation. It's part of their series, In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom. For more information, you can go to lannan.org. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.